So hello everyone, welcome to the podcast, Farmers and Friends of the Kickapoo. I'm Robert Bauer. I'm a grazing specialist for Golden Sands RC&D in Viroqua, Wisconsin. And Golden Sands RC&D is a 501c3 nonprofit based in Stevens Point, serving 12 counties in central Wisconsin, working across county lines cooperatively to improve natural resource, address natural resource issues, and economic development. And I'm here today with Tom Lukens, a landowner on the West Fork of the Kickapoo River. And we're going to talk about the work that Tom's done on his property and look at some really interesting features here. And also just talk about what's going on in the watershed with land use and agriculture and conservation. So, Tom, you want to go ahead and introduce yourself a little bit more? Tell me more about your background.
Tom Lukens, and I've been on this little piece of the West Fork now for 22 years. I had a career in horticulture, but came here not really familiar with prairie and riparian habitat work, which I've become fully engrossed in since. And we run a little three cabin rental business here, Nature Looks Retreat on the West Fork. But most importantly, we try to tend the native species and improve habitat around here.
Mm-hmm. So tell me more about the history of your property. How did you come to acquire it?
Well, unlike some, I got lucky. I shot for property less than one day. I came here, took a walk, put up some wood ducks, saw some turtles in the stream, saw some trout, and made an offer. It took me less than 24 hours to end up with this piece of what I'm forever grateful to be part of now.
Okay, awesome. What was the property like when you first got it? Do you remember some of the things that were going on here?
Well, the river was inaccessible. The banks were largely 6 to 8 feet slumping mud, matter of fact, the guy who'd been farming the ground for the previous 12 years had only been to the river once because he had to crawl through the briars and stuff to get down here. So it was a bit of a mess. Been on the market for a year, but it was just a sleeping jewel.
Cool. Okay, so what are some of the things that you've worked on since you got the property?
Well, we've done a half a mile of stream bank improvements, including some fish habitat work and the rest of it. But when I got involved, I didn't want to think fish only and walked into the local county cons office and said, yeah, how about fish are good, but how about the non-game species? I'm a turtle and snake amphibian kind of fan. And so we did some of the first non-game habitat restoration work paid for with EQIP and wildlife habitat improvement, WIP money. And that first of that work, I think it was about 20, 21 years ago.
Oh, what was that you did? Tell me more about the project.
Well, I got the state herpetologist involved and he came out and walked. It was Bob Hay at the time. And we put in some turtle basking logs, some place for the turtles to get out of the water and dry the leeches off of them and just do good things for their shell hardness and the rest of it. And then put in a snake hibernacula for non-poisonous snakes. There's several species that hibernate underwater. And so those were that we built a cloth-lined rock bit that was two-thirds under the water table. And we made some backwaters for the frogs. And then also armored some stream, put in big boulders, put in some lunkers for the trout. So basically trying to make it suit as many critters as possible.
Yeah, well, why don't we back up a little bit? I guess I'm just kind of in awe of all the habitat work you're describing here. How did you come to want to do that? What inspired you with that, or just in your upbringing that motivated you to do that?
Well, as a kid in Michigan, you know, nothing was more thrilling than catching turtles or snakes and frogs. So I, you know, like a lot of us, you start young, it kind of stays with you. So I kind of had this attraction to those critters, and when it was farmed in all corn row crop, it didn't really favor them very much. So we converted to prairie and did the rest of it. But it was, I was also on the board of a resource conservation district in Monterey Bay, California.
Oh, okay.
So I knew something about the funding access, who to ask questions of, and how to get signed up for EQIP contracts. So within a year of owning the property, because we had such a good county con who worked very closely with the Natural Resource Conservation Service, I was able to get lined up within a year, cost share for $34,000 worth of projects, of which I paid 35%, and the rest was cost shared because it was farm ground being farmed organically. That put us up in the queue a little bit higher.
Very cool. Wait, so how long ago was that you did these projects?
22 years ago when I bought the property, and we had our work going on by 20 years. I think within the first year we began contract work on the first $34,000 worth of projects. And that's when the snake hibernacula went in. That's when the turtle basking logs went in. So we got off to a good start, partly because I knew where to begin, which was in the local NRCS office.
Very cool. Okay. And so those structures are still in place, and are we going to get to kind of go?
Yeah, we'll see some of those. Most of the lunker structures are still in place. The logs. We built a turtle hibernacula too, which was one of the first to go in the state, and it never functioned very well, but that's what happens when you're trying something first off. They've since improved on that design and put them on the inside banks for sediments to fill in,
So you've learned some things, and then it sounds like maybe, like you said, Jeff Hastings or other people, they've learned some things as well from your project since you were the first.
Yeah, I think management for single species is a mistake. And if you're managing exclusively for trout and you've never thought once that a turtle needs to be able to get out of the water on a log structure, and all you're interested in is having clean casting space, I think you're kind of forsaking the potential of the riparian of the corridor.
Okay, I'm going to catch up with you, Tom.
But this kind of banks here, I'm going to put them so they're in my rear view mirror here. You see those steep mud slumping banks? That's what the majority of the river looked like when I bought it. So those have been pulled back, shaped, in some cases armored, in some cases just sloped and reseeded with perennial vegetation. So here in the West Fork, banks like that were caused by poor farming practices of the 20s and 30s. Those sediments used to be on the top of the ridges or on the hillsides. We're coming up to the edge of the property line here. That's a little bit of a heart-pounding effort to get up that riffle.
Okay, sounds good.
This little stream coming in behind us, that's the one that we looked at on the map. Has colder water coming in there, and to impress the grandkids, I've gone up there and caught trout with my bare hands.
Yes, you were telling me earlier about some of the wildlife that you see. I know you mentioned about, you know, turtles and snakes. What other kind of wildlife?
Yeah, when we Lots of beaver initially, and they seem to come and go periodically. Mm-hmm. I've worked with the beaver and encouraged them, and but we have beaver, mink, otter, at least five different species of turtles, painted, snappers, spiny soft-shelled, blanding, wood turtles. And several species of innocuous little snakes, red bellies and common browns and ringneck snakes. It's just been, as a fan, I couldn't be happier with the diversity we got going here.
So do you see these all yourself, or do you work with specialists who've come out and kind of help you find?
We put this entire property in a conservation easement with a local land trust called Mississippi Valley Conservancy. So though I could ID some of those, they qualify your property for what has conservation value before they will agree to come in and work with you on an easement. So they took a 2-hour walk, a couple of really knowledgeable people, and counted species and reported back that at that time the site set the single site species count record for their qualifying walks. So it just we got bottom land, we got a couple 3 ponds, we got a 8-10 springs, and then we got hillsides with hardwood forests. So it's just a fortunate little piece of the landscape. It's got a lot of diversity.
And that sounds so cool. Every day, I bet you get to see different things every season of the year.
Yeah, whether it's watching the bald eagles mate with the spotting scope from the house, or the trout jump, or catching the otter on the game camera. There's always something to do. I can wake up and say, what can I do for the plants and animals today, and feel like I'm doing something.
So I want to shift gears a little bit to some of the other things we're going to look at on the paddle today. You mentioned you have some other projects going on, some of which are helping wildlife, but just kind of using the property in other ways. Do you want to share more about other things you have going on?
Yeah, well, I started, 12 years ago, getting a mixed herd of goats and sheep in here on a rotational grazing basis, at first to try to control Japanese hops, which didn't work well, but they ate the poison parsnip. So I've had every year now for 6-8 weeks, late spring, early summer, I've had a grazing herd rotationally moving through most of the bottom ground, again for invasive control, keep it from becoming shrub ground, and it just helping quite a bit.
I'm gonna have a lot of questions about this, just given my line of work.
Sure.
How do you set that up? What kind of tools are you using to do it?
Well, we first got this grant for early detection and control Japanese hops, and then got a provision written in that allowed us to use grazing animals as part of our effort, as a test. So that helped us get going, and it was apparent that there was a business in the area, Vegetation Solutions, that rented animals at a per head per day fee for this kind of vegetation control. And in the long run, after 3 years of paying for them, I now get the herd without cost, because it helps him out with mothers and young, and he knows he doesn't have to worry about the animals when they're here. So.
Okay, so then it sounds like maybe you do the daily management of the animals.
That's right.
You're setting up fences. What kind of fences are you using? How do you power them to keep the animals in?
Electric mesh net fencing. I think it's called low impedance fencing, where every little square in the mesh is a complete circuit, so it doesn't short out when the grass grows up around it. It's and they're solar charged. They roll up, so you roll them back out, and then Just one person can fence an acre in less than an hour and a half or something. You just got to mow it to get a little bit of a path through there, and roll the fence out and pop it up and ground it, and put the electric charger up. So it's really an elegant system. Walking the fence line once or twice a day to make sure that the deer haven't gone through it and knocked it down. Don't want them getting out and going to the neighbor's property. So, but it's pretty low maintenance. Once it's set up, you're not talking about a half hour, 45 minutes a day. We get the fence to the river because goats and sheep don't like to get their feet wet. So we don't have to fence along the river. It's a fence of its own.
That's really interesting. And you know, I had questions about like, how do you work with access to water?
Well, we fence to the river, and they just drink out of the river. I do have a couple of paddocks that won't have access to the river. And then we have a watering trough, and I'll just carry 5-gallon buckets down there. Right now the herd's only 40 animals. They don't drink that much water. One visit a day. I've had as many as 80, but it's water and minerals. That's the only thing you got to do. So fill up the mineral dispenser every day or every other day. Coming through a little bit of white water here.
Gonna take a little pause here as we navigate that.
The kayak put in.
Or do you get out, or do you just
no go just. Down? Okay. Hit in the middle of a V and you'll be good. Okay. So this again is what's behind me. This is a bank that was armored probably 20 years ago in the first river work. It's been hammered with floods, washed away some of the topsoil, but it's largely remained in place, and it's made a fishing hole there. It's 6 feet deep or so, and but we're gonna fall right off the end of that initial work into an area that didn't have any protection done to it, and as you will see, it's as we go down here that it's not in very good shape. This is shallow here, so gonna do a little scraping, but no big deal. Yeah, we're gonna stay with the water a little bit to the right. Yeah. But here again, in a place that we didn't do any work, you can see those mud banks behind me. That's what a great deal of the river looked like when we first got here. The bank behind me here was shaped and rocked, and you can see it it's staying in place here now. And
what do we have up ahead that you
right here? We got some big boulders that were placed as fish habitat, because fish hang out in the slack water and get the food coming down either side of the boulders. So that's what these are. And in this bank coming up here that's going to be over this shoulder, that's where the first turtle hibernacula went in that actually turned more into a trout lunker than anything else. You can see there's the wood lunker structures in here. We left logs in place trying to slow the water down. But it, it's become more fish habitat than turtle hibernacula now. And now they've changed that into putting them on the inside banks, which makes better sense. It's where the water slows down and where the silts will build up, because the turtles need to get back in there. And they're used to hibernating in rooty banks where they can nestle their way back in there and stay out of predator's reach. But we've don't have a lot of big trees along our stream banks here, so trying to kind of replicate that.
And you mentioned like some of the banks are still overhanging. You're able to do some stream work on certain sections and there's other sections.
That's right. This section behind me here, all this was part of the initial work. So this is held up for some 20 years now. And then we tried to plant natives back there, but the specs require for quick establishment, more non-native cold season. So you end up over-sowing natives, which makes them difficult to establish. But establishing natives in a flood zone is really difficult. Junk comes down, sediments come down, cover the seed, and it's an uphill battle in the flood zone.
Yeah, I know natives are something you're really passionate about. You mentioned you have another area of natives on the property too, is that right?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of an author called Douglas Ptolemy, who's about plant natives for biodiversity. So, you focus on the most important species, the keystone species. In woodies, in trees, that would be oaks, the stone fruit family, and the willow family. So the Quercus, the Prunus, and the Salix genus are most important. So I focused on the species that support the most wildlife because I got a charter here to protect and enhance biodiversity and carrying capacity. So pretty much everything I've planted, I've tried to rank them by how much biodiversity they support, which is generally indexed by the number of Lepidoptera species they support, since that's what that's the butterflies and moths, because it's the larva of those insects that support the neotropical bird migrants, and so they are hugely valuable for diversity. So what I plant, I run through a website called Native Plant Finder. It's National Wildlife Federation website. You're probably familiar with Robert. And another one, same database, is Audubon's Plants for Birds. So I look there before I decide what I'm going to plant, because they're ranked by how many Lepidoptera species they support.
That's really cool. I really enjoyed seeing the oaks. You said you protected them. Been along like for decades, it looks like, protecting different oaks to make sure that they can grow up and be like open grown.
Oaks, because we have so much deer pressure here, we have a size curve in the oaks in our area that really it's 65 70 years and older that we have more oaks. The younger trees have been pretty much decimated by too many deer, so we really don't have good oak reproduction. And since oaks are known to support some 550 species of Lepidoptera, not necessarily right here, I think it's 300 some, so that's what makes oaks a keystone. And I gotta put little mesh tubes around them to keep the mice and rabbits away from them, and larger fences to keep the deer off of them. And then every spring I do the deer wire shuffle, putting bigger and bigger wires on them until they reach 12, 15 feet tall, and they got good lateral branching below, which will keep the buck from coming in and rubbing them and killing them. So yeah, it's a long-term process. If you can't just plant them and walk away from them.
And Lepidoptera, those are like moths and butterflies?
Moths and butterflies. It's the caterpillars. It's noted that a single chickadee to raise a brood, and sometimes they raise two broods a season, requires 7,000 to 9,000 caterpillars to feed that single brood. So if you planted a dang ginkgo that supports absolutely nothing because it came from Southeast Asia, you're doing nothing for the bird life. But if you plant an oak, you're doing wonders. Or if you plant an elderberry, any number of native shrubs or trees will support those little caterpillars. And then you got to not wince when you see the leaves are getting eaten, because that's why you did it, is to provide the food. Those are little carbohydrate and protein packets, those little caterpillars. And that's why even non-insect eating birds will feed their young insects and caterpillars when the young are growing. Then they'll go back to being seed eaters, but yeah.
That's incredible. I enjoy that Doug Ptolemy's work as well.
Yeah, nature's best hope, bringing nature home. I, I don't really care to think of myself as a proselytizer, but if somebody brings the subject up, I'll go on about that.
Yeah, that inspired me to plant some oak trees.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah, see now, this, I'm gonna turn this way so people can see behind me. When you look back here, and you'll see this, see that one oak there that's in the, behind my right shoulder. All the rest of the trees in there were shrubs, briars, brambles, barberry, all kinds of stuff. And so I actually flagged the trees I wanted to keep, and we removed the others, and have since put prairie in that area. But it was so dense that you couldn't get to the river. The guy who had farmed for 12 years ahead of this had seen the river only once or twice, and he had to crawl on all fours to get down here because it was just choked.
And so now you're managing some of the prairie with goats and sheep, you said, is that right? Or just goats?
Yeah.
Or what tools do you use to manage the prairie? Fire?
Well, you know, the pre-establishment work, most of the work is like painting. It's in the prep. It's getting the seed bed exhausted, whether that's with tillage or herbicides. Keeping it fallow for 18 months is what they suggest, and then sowing perhaps in the fall or spring if necessary. And then in the first year, you got to keep it from getting, from the competition, from getting over 16, 18 inches tall. So I most recently established prairie. I think I actually, it was a wet year. I had to mow that thing 10, 12 times.
What did you use to mow it?
A tractor with a brush hog, but you need to not mow it below 5 or 6 inches.
Mm-hmm.
Usually most mowers won't go above 5 inches. I got a big 5-inch bed or 5-foot bed, a riding mower that I used some on that as well. But yeah, it's basically mowing the first year, maybe once or twice at the outside the second year, and then letting it go. And then usually it takes 4 or 5 years to get enough fuel built up in there to be able to burn. And then on a 3 or 4 year rotation, we burn different sections at a time, and never burn everything at once because you need refugia. And so it's a rotational burn program about every 3-4 years for me.
That's so cool. Were there any specific programs you used to seed the prairies? Or?
We were able to get the perennial cover. I think it's NRCS 327 or something, but I got prairie establishment funds for the one. The second one I did. The first one I didn't realize there was cost share available, but I got some help.
So that's USDA is like Natural Resources Conservation Service.
Yes.
And then 327 I think is like called conservation cover.
Yes.
Does that sound?
That's right.
Like what you
exactly.
did.
Exactly. Okay. And then there's little subsections of conservation cover that will apply, whether it's pollinator plantings or native prairie establishment. The pollinator plantings have become very popular, but.
Do you remember what your mix was like? It was for pollinators, or do you remember?
The pollinator mix was too scarce for me. I mean, too sparse. They had only a dozen species or something in it. I planted 50 species in that one up there and 38 species in this prairie over here. So I worked a different angle and prairie establishment rather than pollinator. But at the time, it was a cost share project and basically paid for the seed and all the labor was mine, so it was without cost.
Do you remember where you got the seed?
Yeah, I started initially with Prairie Moon seed, and then I think I've ended up more recent years with Shooting Star Nursery, also out of Minnesota. But they'll, you know, you're looking for native seed, and that's right outside of Winona, so it's not too far from us, but yeah.
It sounds like you were thinking about the distance, you know, how close the seed was.
That's right. Although I'm not a purist, you know, I got some dark cone flower in here, not just the pale cone flower, you know. I mean, guys can get really, you can get really concerned about what was native to your 50-mile radius. I haven't been that particular, but yeah, I certainly have tried to get stuff that will grow in this zip code and that was native to it wherever I possibly could.
So it looks like we have another rapids here.
That's right, and we're gonna stick to the middle of this, where there's whitest water. I don't know what's making that. Yeah, that went in when we did some river work, because we needed to get across the river, so it was a ford for trucks and my tractor at one point. But again, we're looking at shaped banks. And here you can see research suggests that river birch has one of the strongest tensile strength roots of any riparian corridor tree, and so I'll swing around here and you'll see these series of river birch planted along this bank here. Some of them are in wire cages, but those were all planted because that bank gets hammered when the water's high, and if I wanted to see, since a slump had already started, I wanted to see if those river birch would hold that slump in place. I did another one where I planted a bunch of sedge and some other slumps, because sedges seem to hold the banks really well. But they're hard to establish, so they don't get used much. But yeah, there's a couple dozen river birch planted up there as an experiment to hold that slumping bank. And then there's red osiers up on top of that because they rank high. And they're a native that has four-season interest. And for humans, you know, that red bark in the winter, they got blooms on them right now. They're a great landscape plant, and they're tough. So
I know you've done some other work planting trees and shrubs, hazelnuts, for example. You know, can you tell me more about your journey with hazelnut growing and marketing?
Yeah, I simply planted hazels because I like to plant stuff, and then I got involved with a woman who could not, Pam, who's now my wife, who couldn't have managed just to think that this is just for the wildlife. She works for the American Hazelnut Company. They're trying to create markets. They got a series of products now. Hazels are commercially produced with a European strain. Even in Oregon, it's a European strain they use. But the American hazelnut, hazel is a shrub and not a tree. There are a lot of agronomic challenges, one of which is getting uniform genetics on a plant that is wind pollinated. They don't clone well. So trying to get something with a harvest that's uniform and right now, an awful lot of what you plant doesn't produce good quality or quantity of nuts. So it's definitely an industry in its beginnings, but has a lot of promise, and perennials on the landscape is the way to go versus a lot of row crops.
I've certainly been seeing a lot more interest in planting hazelnuts and other perennial woody shrubs and trees.
It only makes sense. Well, the average slope in the West Fork here for farm ground is 13%, for goodness sakes. You get heavy rains on 13% slope and you got sediments. Anything we can do to decrease tillage, keep living roots in the soil, is important. So,
I know you mentioned about the sediment that's built up down in the valley here.
Yeah, here's another bank. Now the river work ended here. And here we go with another big slumping mud bank. Like I say, the river work has ended here, and now you can see what a lot of this looked like initially. Yeah, it's...
So Tom, can you tell me more about the history with your hazelnut planting? Like, when did you plant it, and you know, what have you experienced specifically here?
Well, I think I planted the hazels, 12 years ago or so. It's kind of the 80-20 rule. 20% of your plants are producing 80% of your crop. And that means there's a lot of wasted space out there. So it's, and ideally they get planted on spacings where you can use, do machine harvesting. They've adapted blueberry pickers, big shaking mobile units that to collect the nuts, and that means tree morphology is also important. So you don't want to have a big, wide, multi-stem shrub necessarily. The agronomics are still being worked out. The genetics, like I say, since they don't clone well in tissue culture lab, and geez, you know, the Red Delicious apple came from one sport on one tree in Eastern Washington or some damn thing. You know, it's been tissue cultured up. Not that I like the apple, but if you can't vegetatively propagate something in big numbers, you're handicapped in trying to get uniformity. Of course, that's what they do with an F1 hybrid seed, but this is not necessarily a true from seed, and it's wind pollinated. You don't get to control the pollen very much. So, yeah, it's... got lots of challenges, but it's the breeding aspects, the selections. There are some trees that are so much better than others. If you could make thousands of those, then you got something. So we keep messing around more on a selection and propagating end of things than legitimate production.
Sure. I'm sure you're involved in a lot of those different conversations that are going on. Yeah. How did you plant them? What was the configuration you planted in? Was it wide enough to use the machine harvester?
No, that's the thing. They're now talking about 18, 20 foot in between rows. And I think I went 12 feet between rows. And now I'm taking rows out. But not that I'll ever have the quantity to try to machine harvest, but it gets difficult to try to mow and even to get in there to pick. But if you're hand picking, you're not going to make money. But it feels good. I love having roasted hazels around in the nut bowl.
It gives you the opportunity to kind of connect with the work you're doing and see what's working, what's not working, too, and the variation.
Yeah, and when you're going to plant hazels, you try to plant them not close to the woods because the squirrels secondarily the blue jays are the biggest robbers of your crop. So
okay, so I'm seeing some fence now, so I'm guessing we're at a point, maybe this is an access point.
This is the next paddock I'll run the goats and sheep in. If you're running these things rotationally, you like to get set up for the next paddock in case they push the fence, because you'll never get them back into something they already grazed. So that fence, now this here is where the animals have been now. You can see they like this one shady spot, so they kind of hammered that piece of bank. But there are a few sheep up there looking at us. This is just a little, I don't know what it is. You can guess it for me, a little couple acre paddock. But again, I get mothers and young, so they get used to being other places and getting the, being out with the electric fence, and then he'll take the animals back midsummer.
Mm-hmm. How do you decide how big to make these paddocks then?
By experience. If they're too big, they just cherry pick it. And if you want them to go after some of the rougher stuff, if you really want them to go after the poison parsnip, then you don't give them too much to choose from. They like the poison parsnip, but yeah, so it's kind of an experience thing. If I make them too big, I just don't get enough vegetation control.
Mm-hmm. So what else are they grazing on here? Do you
well, you know, this is a lot of reed canary down here. Mm-hmm. They don't like the sedges so much, so in the sedge heavy paddocks they leave more behind. But yeah, this was old pasture ground. There are old photos showing that this was even cropped at one point. Mm-hmm. but it was mostly pasture, so there's a lot of cold season grasses and darn reed canary. A lot of hairy fruited lake sedge. But yeah.
So this year you said you have 40 sheep. Is it right?
Yeah, it's 20 and 20. 20 goats, 20 sheep.
Okay. And are you noticing differences in what they're tending to eat?
Well, you know, goats are usually, you know, going after the woodier stuff, and the sheep, the more herbaceous stuff, but depends on what they were raised on too. Look, there's some garlic mustard. Yuck. So these animals are got a pretty wide-ranging diet because uses them for vegetation control.
Sure. Do you have to separate the mineral then for those two groups, or they all?
No, it's the same mineral. Now they kind of hang out together, but that's just a mixed herd.
So it's just a blended mineral kind of thing. You don't have any kind of free choice.
And this is one of the things that, as you know, the water was a little higher here a couple days ago, and so as I look at this good example of that mesh fence, and this fencing here over my shoulder is what we use, and they don't like to get their feet wet, so I can just fence to the river. But I see I need to move that down closer because they might push that now. But anyway, it's real easy to fence. That's hot. That's in a solar charge. And this is generally where, this is toward the edge of the property line. This is where generally take out, but we have these really interesting 450 million year old sandstone cliffs down here, a couple hundred yards, that we'll go down there and turn around. This is a paddock they already left, and it's already regenerating a lot.
Do you have a certain height that you're targeting when you take them out?
You know, I'd like to see it eaten down pretty well, but this is the neighbor's property line, and if I leave them, make them get too hungry in here, they might push the fence and get over into the neighbor's tree. So, it's, you know, if you were rotationally grazing cattle, you know, you may be having a two-day rotation in a small paddock, but this isn't quite as controlled as that.
But you said you move them every day, is that right? Or how often do you move them?
Yeah, in this case, they were in this two-acre paddock for probably 9 days, and it's just about, it's day eight now in the paddock that they're in, and I'm thinking I'll move them in a day or two. We got a lot of beaver activity down here. Last year this was corn, and the beaver were visible all the time. And looks like we got a little food stash that the beaver have made right up here.
Just real quick, so your overall pasture is how many acres, and then how many days of grazing, or how many months?
I usually have the animals for no more than 8 weeks. You know, starting mid-May or something. The total acreage they graze, it may be maybe 15 acres. Mm-hmm. And some of it I graze harder than others. If I put them on a hill slope, I don't leave them in very long. It's not so scientific as if you were, you know, raising beef cattle and this is more for unwanted vegetation control, and because it helps my friend the grazer out.
Definitely. So I'm hearing like a little bit over 2 animals per acre.
Okay.
Well, does that match what you said? 15.
Yeah. You know, I've never bothered to figure that out.
Which is pretty light, you know, stocking density for livestock. But you've been here a long time, and I wanted to ask you about what you've noticed. You know, how the water, the river itself, or the watershed has changed in that time.
Well, the West Fork has always had less turbidity, better water visibility than the main fork. Partly because there's less agriculture upstream, less row cropping, and also because the West Fork got a lot of Trout Unlimited stream restoration attention. So there's been a lot of grant money spent in this watershed for improved habitat, like the kind of stuff we have just seen. So and because it's not a, there's not a lot of ag ground up north, there's some more of, or upstream I should say, there is not quite as much pressure that way. There's a lot of recreational landowners, is what I want to say. And watershed councils are one of the good things that's happening with producer-led watershed councils. I was involved with helping a couple of those get started. And but they generally have a producer focus, because there's farm bill dollars, there's conservation dollars available for fencing or watering structures, or perhaps for prairie strips or for grassed waterways. But for recreational landowners, there are very few cost-sharing opportunities. I was fortunate in that it was being farmed when I bought it, and I knew enough to leave the farming operation intact, or else you are not available for consideration for some of these environmental quality incentive program, these EQIP contracts. So it's unfortunate that people come in and buy a decent sized piece of property and think that the farmers are their enemies, because they're really not. Farming practices might be able to be improved, but leaving some in agricultural production does give you access to more resources. And so it's kind of a big mistake to boot the renter off your ground when you buy it. Make him give you a 50-foot buffer along the stream. Take some acres off of the lease, but you can insist on some conservation practices yourself. We're here along this 480 million year old sandstone, and this is where there's in the fall, it's some of these little cracks in the limestone I was telling you about, Robert, where the several species of small snake congregate and actually overwinter. So I come down here in the fall and find little 8-inch long ringneck or red-bellied snakes hanging in the moss. Sometimes you see them during the summer, but usually they congregate in the fall. This is a western exposure, so they get a good long light. Yeah, there'll be wildflowers hanging off of this thing. There'll be bird nests in some of these little crevices. And in the winter, they'll have icicles that reach the water here.
So what I was hearing is, overall, you feel like the water quality is improving to some extent in the watershed.
Well, improving, but we've lost a lot of contour strips. The farm pressure is pretty, to crank every bushel they can out of it. It's I think that overall in this area, we're going backwards. Partly because there are fewer animals on the landscape. There aren't mixed farming operations with livestock and row crops. There are fewer of them, so there's less call for self-produced hay and forage. So if you're a row cropper, you don't need hay. I think that the county numbers would tell you that we're losing contour strips, we're not gaining them. You know, with our recent floods, all the PL-566s in the West Fork, all the way up the Coon Valley and stuff, a couple, three in Monroe County, but I think 7 or 8 in Vernon County got blown out. And now they're going to tear them all out. Originally put in for flood control, but they've also had a 50-year lifespan. But it's... unfortunately, it's an engineering solution to a systems problem. They're going to structurally tear out these dams and notch them, which is going to increase water velocity and send it down the middle, going to increase erosive pressure downstream, rather than saying, hey, we got an opportunity to slow and spread this water out. This is a wetland creation opportunity behind these sediment basins, that behind these dams. It's an engineering solution. When we originally put in those dams, they required 50% of the land that drained into any given PL 566 dam, earthen dam, have a conservation program that they adhered to. And now they're trying to solve the problem without even talking to the upstream landowners. So I think it's a squandered opportunity. But again, the NRCS or the feds want to get out from underneath that liability. And I understand that, but there is a notching and sending it down the river at higher velocities is a squandered opportunity.
Do you remember, Tom, offhand, the years when there's been flooding on the West Fork?
Yeah, well, there were floods in 07 and 08. And the big one that wiped out the PL 566s was 2018. That took out so many of those dams. But we've since had a couple of overbank events, even since 18, pretty good-sized floods. I think we had one in 21, spring of 21. But, you know, there was a period of time there where in 12 years we had 3 500-year flood events. 12 years, 3 500-year events. Now, the words don't make any sense anymore. And unfortunately, those rainfall numbers, when they cite some of these large containment feed operations, they're using outdated rainfall numbers. They haven't updated some of that stuff. And we had the wettest decade on record at one point here. That was about 2008 to 2020, the most rainfall I'd ever recorded.
You track rainfall.
Yeah, and those are Madison area numbers too. I mean, that's not just mine. But in all the records, there was a muskrat home. But now we're into 4 years of relatively dry. So we're kind of swinging back and forth here.
How do you think people and the landscape should handle that or deal with that type of fluctuation?
Well, that's where perennial cover and buffers, I think, are one of the things you can do.
Does it affect how you manage your land? Having the floods versus having the droughts now?
Yeah, well, you know, getting rid of the cornfields that went right up to the riverbank was one of the first things I did, and put in prairie. Or slope the bank and put in, cold season pasture mix. That's one of the things that they will accept.
Well, I know, you know, was it 2023? We had a D4 drought in, I'd say, Gays Mills area, yeah. Prairieville area. And so that's like, extreme drought, I think, uh-huh. is the classification for that. And of course, being in the bottoms, you probably had green grass.
It was really dry.
You did not.
Yeah, we got a wetland up here that really suffered during that. Yeah, that.
So, did you bring goats and sheep out that year, or what did you do?
Well, you know, it was not something that you could float upstream much. We were still able to float this little stretch of river and. A lot of swimming, and we got tubes for the families that come to stay at Nature Nooks and stuff. So there was a lot of river play, but the fishing, the trout fishing was shut off. One of the changes that we see is that we have more warm days where the water temperature, or warm water temperatures, where they exceed 68 degrees, and which is hazardous for trout fishing. So there are more days that a judicious trout fisherman shouldn't be stressing these fish out. So that's one change we have noticed. We got hotter summers. If the base flow is less, then it just heats up faster. So,
well, Tom, I'm going to wrap up the podcast for now. And I said it earlier, but I am really in awe of your property and all the work that you've done. Thank you for sharing.
Well, thanks. And it's the National Fish and Wildlife Federation's native plant finder by zip code that should instruct what we put in the ground around here. It's a wonderful website. It's just rich with data. So you can plug in your zip code, and if you're looking for trees or shrubs or herbaceous stuff, it'll tell you what's the best stuff to plant. 5% of the local flora support 70% of the fauna. So that's the definition of a keystone. It's one of those critically important things that supports a disproportionate amount of the local wildlife. And the National Fish and Wildlife Federation's Native Plant Finder by zip code is a dynamite site.
Thanks for sharing all the resources. And we mentioned a lot of different programs. I'll also make a pitch that folks can go on the Golden Sands RCND website at goldensandsrcd.org. And you'll see a lot of different tools and resources. Our managed grazing team has put together a website of resources where we've been recording webinars talking about farm finances and managed grazing. And there's a lot of other tools, like where you can get a no-till drill, for example, to plant prairie or pasture. And if folks have more questions about, you know, managed grazing, sustainable agriculture, water quality, invasive species, then they can reach out through the website. So again, thanks so much for coming on Farmers and Friends of the Kickapoo with me, Tom.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
This document was made possible through a grant from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. This material is based upon work supported by the U.S. Department of Agriculture under Agreement 2004.25.085349. The views and conclusions contained in this document are those of the authors and should not be interpreted as representing the opinions or policies of the U.S. government or the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation and its funding sources. Mention of trade names or commercial products does not constitute their endorsement by the U.S. government or the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation or its funding sources. Prepared with assistance from USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service. USDA is an equal opportunity provider and employer.
This podcast was brought to you by Golden Sands RCND, copyright 2025, all rights reserved.